Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Congressman Patrick Murphy, Democrat from Pennsylvania, knows how decisions made in Washington are felt by American soldiers in Iraq. He was a captain and a paratrooper over there with the 82nd Airborne. Now, as the only Iraq War veteran in Congress, he's written a no-holds-bar memoir. In it, he writes, "Soldiers on the ground are paying the price, picking up the pieces, the shambles of the president's failed plan." This hour, On Point, Congressman Patrick J. Murphy and his Iraq story. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Democratic Congressman Patrick J. Murphy. He joined Army ROTC to pay for college and climbed through the ranks to become the youngest professor at West Point. In 2003, he shipped out to Iraq as a captain with the 82nd Airborne, and then with $322 in his pocket, he ran for Congress and won a hard-fought battle with the Republican incumbent. Since January 2007, he's represented Pennsylvania's 8th District. Now he's out with a memoir about his remarkable journey titled Taking the Hill from Philly to Baghdad to the United States Congress. Welcome, Congressman Patrick Murphy.
Hey, Jane. Great to be with you today.
Thank you. Good to have you. After reading your book, I must say you really are an American success story. And I'm wondering, growing up as a scrappy kid in a good Irish Catholic family in Northeast Philly, what were your dreams for yourself?
Well, you know, for a long time, Jane, all I wanted to do was be a cop like my father. And, you know, I didn't do very well academically in grade school or in high school, but you know, I got a wake-up call. I applied to where my brother went to college. I only applied to one school. I thought I was going to go there and play hockey, and I was rejected. It was from King's College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and you know, I realized, you know, I really need to get my act together, so I went to the local community college, and at that time, it was 1991, and on 9/11 of 1991, one of my really good friends was killed, and you know, it was like, wow. And I said, listen, I got to turn my life around here. And I did that, made the dean's list, and, you know, just put my nose to the grindstone.
And so how was it that you made your way to the military? How did that path reveal itself to you?
Well, I eventually went to community college and then transferred to King's College and joined the Army ROTC. It was my roommate and I joined up. We took the military science class, and I fell in love with the military. I liked the discipline. I liked the fact that it was focused on results. You know, you either win the battle or you don't win, or you either win the war or you don't win. And I liked the camaraderie. So, you know, my father had served in the Navy during the Vietnam era. I was named after a Vietnam hero, Patrick Ward, who gave his life for our country over in Vietnam. Hmm. And my mom's twin brother, my uncle, was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division and was a Vietnam vet himself. So, you know, I just followed, you know, what everyone else did in my family. I joined the military, was commissioned as a second lieutenant, and then eventually was lucky enough to go to law school. And then, you know, when I finished law school, I went into the Army JAG Corps and was a prosecutor, which was a terrific job. And then was lucky enough to be asked to join the faculty at West Point to teach constitutional law to the next generation of military leaders there, which was a great honor. I'll never forget, you know, teaching the firsties, the seniors there at West Point. And it was an important course, Jane, because you take an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So to teach them about that Constitution that they have to take an oath to support and defend, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
So you had a tour of duty after that in Bosnia. And then in 2003, you shipped off to Baghdad as a captain
right.
with the prestigious 82nd Airborne, as we mentioned. What were your first impressions when you got on the ground in Iraq, Congressman?
Well, on, you know, when I was first there, you know, if I could just backtrack real quick, Jane, you know, on 9/11 of 2001, when I was teaching at West Point, it was a great honor to teach there, but, you know, I wanted to go serve and deploy to defend my nation. And I as you mentioned, I deployed twice, and on that second deployment was to Baghdad, Iraq. And, you know, I got there. I was linking up with the 2nd Brigade Combat Team that was part of the invasion force over there. And I was in Al-Rashid, Baghdad, which is south-central Baghdad. District has about 1.5 million Iraqis. And showing up at that Ford operating base in the heart of the city and seeing the hundreds of Iraqis that were outside the gates, you know, just, you know, trying to get help, you know, saying, can we have water? You know, where's the electricity? And really turning to us. And, you know, the kind of the look of somewhat of bewilderment, not knowing, you know, what to do and where to turn. You know, you go and we would convoy, you know, 12 miles up to the green zone or to the airport, and it didn't seem like they knew what was really going on out there.
Hmm. Did you support the war initially? You were at West Point on 9/11. You saw, you know, many young people going off serving their country in this endeavor. Did you support it?
I absolutely supported what was going on in Afghanistan and go after al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, the person who killed 3,000 innocent Americans, including my best friend's girlfriend and her father. But in the spring of 2003, you know, we went there 5 years ago in March as part of the invasion. You know, I remember thinking there was something in my stomach, a gut feeling that something wasn't right. And I remember watching the Chris Matthews show on a Sunday morning, reading the Sunday paper and saying, you know, he was questioning why we were going in there. And it just, and Chris Matthews is from Northeast Philly too. And I remember thinking to myself, I think he's onto something here. And it was what I was feeling in my heart. So, you know, I remember I took out my old Colin Powell book, which I read, My American Journey. He was a role model to me. And reading some parts about, you know, when we should go into war and how we should do it. It's called the Powell Doctrine. And then when Colin Powell testified, I remember saying, okay, well, if he's testifying to the United Nations saying, we have to do this, I trust him. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a soothing feeling. And I thought it was, you know, then, of course, probably the right thing to do if Colin Powell's saying it. I trusted his judgment. And at that point, you know, I had already, you know, although I was a Democrat, I voted for George Bush in 2000. I was when he said he was a compassionate conservative, I believed him. And I vote for the person, not for necessarily the party. And, you know, I voted for him. And so then, to make a long story short, when I was in Iraq, you know, I was there not to question the policy. I was there to execute it. But slowly but surely, when I was there to see how shorthanded we were, Jane, I mean, we were in this place, Al-Rashid Baghdad, which I mentioned, 1.5 million Iraqis, the size of Philadelphia. If we would have followed the counterinsurgency doctrine that we've developed over the decades, one articulated by General Shinseki, four-star general, Vietnam hero, lost part of his foot in Vietnam, the chief of staff, United States Army, he testified to Congress, if we do this is before the invasion, if we do this, we need several hundred thousand troops. And to see him marginalized the very next day by Donald Rumsfeld and by Paul Wolfowitz, and they said, no, we could do it, you know, that he was wildly off the mark and we could do it on the cheap. And the fact is, instead of having the 25,000 or 35,000 in that small district that we had of 1.5 million Iraqis, there was only 3,500 of us.
In fact,
and compare it to my father in Philadelphia, my dad served as a cop for 22 years. There were 7,000 cops in Philly, and there was only half as many of us, law enforcement, in a combat zone where we didn't speak the same language.
So you realized real quickly, right in the middle of it, that there certainly were not enough boots on the ground, as they were saying. You also say in the book, and I'll read here, that 3 weeks after the invasion, commanders were left, quote, holding the bag and scrambling to create a mini Marshall Plan in the absence of support and direction from Washington. So beyond the tactical nightmare you mentioned in the book and just previously about the Iraqis and their struggle for basic necessities, being in the middle of it as a soldier from your perspective, what do you do?
Well, we do what any good paratrooper would do from the 82nd Airborne Division. We took the initiative to do what we could do. And I talk about that in the book about we had Commander's Emergency Response Program, which is basically these little mini Marshall Plans, which we tried to do, but the reality of it is there was only so much we could do. At night, we would conduct combat operations, trying to go against the insurgents that we thought were in the area or that intelligence told us were out there. And then during the day, we tried to win the hearts and minds. And, you know, we had no real help from the State Department, no real help from, you know, reconstruction teams, no real help from the Green Zone or the, you know, new Paul Bremer-led Coalition Provisional Authority. And we were just taking the initiative on our own because we thought it was the right thing to do. And I articulate, you know, what my job was. You know, I led a BOLT team, a Brigade Operational Law Team of the 2nd Brigade Combat Team. So I had six paratroopers, you know, under my watch and under my lead, you know, trying to do what we were supposed to be doing. And that was, you know, trying to rebuild the two courthouses that we were responsible for. Unfortunately, prosecuting our own soldiers when they violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We even tried criminals, high-level criminals of Iraqis in our new Supreme Court that we established. It's called the Central Criminal Court of Iraq. One of those high-level folks was one of the top lieutenants of Mutaqba al-Sadr. His name was Sheikh Muyad, who did some very bad things. And you know, and then, you know, doing claims, which was, you know, when we get in a car accident or sometimes, you know, and that's my book talks about, combat operations. You know, we go in at night, and if we had, you know, intelligence on a high-level insurgent, we go into a home. There's not a mature address system in Baghdad or in Iraq. So unlike here in America, there's no address with the number on outside. We would sometimes go into the wrong house and, you know, kick down the wrong door. And so instead of saying, oops, sorry, you know, we said, oops, sorry, you know, go see Captain Murphy. And I would, you know, reimburse them for the broken door or a car accident with one of our Humvees to try and establish it. And that goes back into one of the fundamental principles of what America stands for, the rule of law, that no one is above the law, not even us, you know, in a foreign land.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with former Army captain and West Point professor turned U.S. Congressman Patrick Murphy about his remarkable journey from Philadelphia to Baghdad to the United States Congress. His new memoir is called Taking the Hill. Congressman Murphy, I was moved by the conversation that you recall in the book with a gunner one day in Baghdad as you were leading a convoy up and down what's called Ambush Alley. You tell us that conversation?
Sure. It was Private First Class Aravello, and he turned to me and he said, sir, what are we doing over here? What's our mission? And, you know, that's a question we should still be asking today. You know, when we were there in 2003, although it was not articulated to us, you know, the mission was, one, get rid of Saddam Hussein. Okay, JNR troops did that. Number two, get rid of the weapons of mass destruction. That job was easy. There weren't any. And three, you know, give the Iraqis some type of representative government. And we've done that. You know, it's been almost 5 years now. They've had several elections. They've passed their constitution. Now we got to say, what are we still doing over there? And in my mind, you know, we are there refereeing a religious civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. And that's not the mission of our military. And, you know, I believe that we need now 5 years later to turn it over to the Iraqis and make them stand up. Because when you look at it, how I used to, you know, lead convoys up and down Ambush Alley, which was the size of I-95 and one of the most dangerous roads in the entire world. You know, it's still the Americans that are leading those convoys and not the Iraqis.
So
and
do you
until
think the
we
Iraqis,
turn it over
though,
to and let them do the heavy lifting, don't let us do it.
Are they capable of building a democracy beyond what they've got, of keeping a military and a police force intact?
I do believe that they are capable. And, you know, it's not going to be, you know, the 51st state of the United States of America, nor should it be. It's their country. And, you know, they've had elections. They've had, you know, several elections, as I mentioned. So, you know, they're not going to be perfect. There's no country that's perfect. But, you know, we can't be doing the heavy lifting for them. And until they finally stand up, you know, we're going to continue to do it for them.
What about the other side of the argument, Congressman, that says that pulling out precipitously will open Iraq to al-Qaeda and create an environment that was that is much worse than it is now or certainly than it was before?
Sure. There's two main criticisms, Jane. First is that, if we give them a timeline, which I've advocated, a 12-month or a 16-month timeline, what they'll do is you're saying, well, we're going to give the timeline to the enemy. No. I'm going to give a timeline. We're going to give a timeline to the Iraqi government to finally stand up and not take a summer vacation like they did this year when our troops are standing up every single day. And second criticism, I don't think it's a valid criticism, is when we leave, al-Qaeda will take over and it'll be an al-Qaeda country. No, it will not. Al-Qaeda is a Sunni organization, an extremist organization, which has already been marginalized in Iraq. And you're ignoring the fact that the majority of Iraqis are not Sunni. They are Shia. And they will not allow a minority group and an extremist at that come in and take over their country. They've already turned their back on al-Qaeda and you know, turned on them because they are extremists. And I'm excited about that. I'm happy about that. But what I'm not happy about is that the al-Qaeda network, which killed 3,000 innocent Americans, are based in the world in Afghanistan and the border of Pakistan. Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, and they are just as strong today as they were on 9/11 of 2001. In fact, their training, to hurt us. They're strategizing to hurt us, and they're getting away with it because we only have 26,000 troops in Afghanistan, and yet we have almost 170,000 troops in Iraq. And we can't focus on al-Qaeda when we're bogged down refereeing this religious civil war now almost 5 years later.
What do you make of the surge, Congressman? Do you believe it's been successful? And what do you make of the calls for General David Petraeus and others to stay the course, that it's working?
Jane, I served under General Petraeus in an earlier deployment, and I have great respect for him. He's a great military leader. But, you know, he's not in charge of the overall strategy. His focus is on Iraq. So, you know, there has been some great, you know, some tactical successes in Iraq, and I'm happy about that. Our troops are doing a great job. And anytime you put 30,000 troops, you know, on the street corners in Baghdad, it's going to be safer. But you're forgetting the big purpose of the surge was to have the political reconciliation, which has not really happened. There's been some small, very small improvements, but it can't happen when you take a summer vacation like the Iraqi government did. And secondly, it keeps our eye off the ball on our true enemy, and that's the extremist group al-Qaeda, and where they're most strong, and that is Afghanistan and the border of Pakistan. Secretary Gates, the Secretary of Defense, was just complaining to NATO last week, saying we need more troops in Afghanistan, we need more troops in Afghanistan. We can't provide those troops because we are so stretched thin in the military. And we're so stretched thin because we're in the middle of refereeing this religious civil war on the streets of Baghdad.
We have some callers who have some questions for you, Congressman Murphy. Let's go first to Todd, who is in Groton, Connecticut. Todd, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Fine. Thank you.
Hi, Congressman Murphy. Real quick, I first would like to say I do support our troops. I think it's great for people to volunteer to risk their lives and separate from their families to protect me. I don't think that they do that and expect to go to a war that was started under false pretenses. So my couple comments real quick is, one, I think that the war is pretty well known that we did go there under false pretenses, basically being lied to by the commander-in-chief for the reason we went to war. And secondly, this war is costing us, you know, I think generally, safely speaking, between $5 and $10 billion a month. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I guess my point is, and my question is what do you say to the taxpayer like myself, you know, who is sitting here and realizing that Americans need money, the VAs that come back from wars and have been injured for the rest of their lives are getting treated badly by the administration. There's people starving in America. There's people that are sick that aren't getting help. And we're wasting all this money on a war that was started basically with lies from our administration. What do you say to the frustrated taxpayer, and how do you make someone, me and the rest of these people, feel better?
Todd, thank you. Congressman.
Todd, thanks for your question. And I'd say get involved. Write letters to the editor. Get active. Support a political candidate, no matter if they're Democrat or Republican, to change what's going on down in Washington. That's the only way we can stop this madness. And, you know, I agree with you. Our troops are our heroes. And, you know, when they sign up, it's to defend America and do the right thing to keep us safe. And the problem is that, you know, we have a Bush administration right now that has forgotten that we're a nation at war, and we're also a nation at debt, Todd, because we owe $10 trillion. That was with the T, $1 trillion. So that means every man, woman, and child in America owes over $29,000 to our national debt. Tom, my wife and I were blessed with a little daughter, Maggie, 14 months ago. She was born in this country owing $29,000 in debt. And this debt is what we're borrowing from other countries like China, like India, South Korea, and we're even borrowing billions off of Mexico. And we're doing that to pay for this war and for some of the, you know, the spending that we can't be affording right now. Things like tax breaks to the wealthiest 1% of Americans. This takes a shared sacrifice, and we're not going to do it unless we make these tough decisions. And, you know, one of these decisions is what's really going on to keep our family safe here at home.
I'm interested in your answer to Todd's question to get involved, because after you left Iraq, that's exactly what you did. You came home, and I wonder if you'd tell us the story of running for Congress with exactly $322 in your bank account up against a Republican incumbent who outspent you, what, about $3 million? Yeah. How was that decision made that you were going to do that?
Well, I talked to my family and I just said, you know, I think this is what we should be doing. And, you know, I think I'm ready to answer the call to try and enter this political arena. And I knew it would be difficult. I knew I had less than a 2% chance to win, but it was a chance that I thought we needed to take because, you know, I felt I was a witness to our foreign policy on what was going on over there. And all the, you know, even the Democrats said to me, listen, Patrick, listen, you're a great young guy. You know, I was 31 years old. They said, but, you know, yeah, you were a prosecutor. Yeah, you were a professor at West Point and, you know, you got a Bronze Star in Iraq. But, you know, you only have $322 in your bank account and no one knows who the heck you are. And I said, well, I'm doing these for the 19 guys that I served with that never made it home.
And you won that vote.
You know,
vote.
I had a tough primary.
Yeah, and won by less than 1% of the vote,
right? Against, what's that?
You won by less than 1% of the vote.
Yeah, in the general election. When I went against this Republican machine and this Republican opponent, it wasn't just, you know, as far as the money disadvantage, but in my district, I come from a Republican-leaning district in suburban Philadelphia. There's still 25,000 more Republicans than Democrats. And, you know, I'm going against this machine. You know, to give you perspective, you know, the majority of the elected officials are Republican. And so here's me back and I'm running. And, you know, I had started out years earlier at the local community college. And they said, you know, this guy doesn't stand a chance. And even the Democrats didn't want me to run because, you know, I wasn't this well-known entity. But, you know, we built this incredible grassroots campaign. And Jaden, when I ran, you know, it's interesting. I'm a football fan. I used to be an Eagle security guard in high school and in college. You know, to have a good offense, you need in football, you need a good ground game and a good air game. Well, the air game is what everyone pays attention to, and the air game and campaigns are the television ads and, you know, the strategists down in Washington. And people were paying attention. I didn't have a lot of money to get on the air. I got on a little bit. But we had an incredible grassroots ground campaign. Mm. On election day, on one day itself, we had over 1,200 people door knocking on over 150,000 doors. And that's what it took, and that's how we won one of the closest races in the entire country. And, you know, that's what we're going to have to do this time because, I'm in a Republican district, and I'm going against someone who's supported by the president and, you know, the right wing of the party.
Well, so I guess moving back just a little bit, as a veteran then, having, you know, won this incredibly intense race, you're a sitting congressman now, you're in Washington, and you're watching Iraq continue to unfold, and you know what it's like driving through enemy fire in a Humvee without adequate armor. You know what it's like on the ground, not enough soldiers trying to keep the peace. So when you hear soldiers dying in IED explosions or other things that are going on, what's going through your mind as a congressman, and what do you do about it?
It breaks my heart, Jane. It gives me chills, and it makes me frustrated that, you know, this Congress last March passed an historic piece of legislation. It was a binding timeline to bring our troops home. We would keep in Iraq a small strategic strike force, but the majority of troops would come home. We passed that in the House. All the political pundits said, oh, you're never going to pass it. We passed it. Then it passed the Senate after they said it wasn't going to happen. And then to see the president veto that legislation, and then we tried to override his veto. Of course, then you need 66%, two-thirds, and we didn't get it because there wasn't enough so-called, quote-unquote, moderate Republicans that were willing to stand up to the president. So, you know, then, unfortunately, a couple months later, we give a piece of legislation that the Republicans drafted. You know, it was basically a blank check to the president on the Iraq war, and I couldn't in good conscience vote for it. And I knew, and a lot of folks said, Patrick, you're in a Republican district. If you vote against this legislation, it was right before Memorial Day, right before, you know, I go back to the American Legions and the VFWs. Hmm. And I knew this was going to be the 32nd ad in my race. I knew they were going to say, you know, something horrible like Murphy turned his back on the troops, et cetera, et cetera. And it just, you know, but I couldn't in good conscience vote for that. And, you know, I voted against it. And knowing that it might be political suicide, but there's so many people, in my opinion, that go down to Washington, they forget where they come from, they're so worried about keeping their seat in Congress that they forget what this is all about. And in my opinion, the election of 2006, and it looks like now the election of 2008, is going to be about bringing our troops home from Iraq and not over there dying on behalf of refereeing a religious civil war and getting caught in a crossfire. So, you know, I stand by the courage of my convictions, and I hope other folks would too as well.
Jerry is calling now from Wallingford, Connecticut. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks.
Hello.
For having me. And Congressman Murphy, thank you so much for serving our country twice, as a veteran and then as a congressman. I won't hold it against you that you're presumably a Phillies fan and I'm a Mets fan, and your team broke my heart. But that's pretty minor. Thanks so much. My question is this. I'm curious about your predictions for next year. You sort of alluded to it just a moment ago, and how you feel things are going to shake down. We know what the Republican Party is capable of in terms of dirty tricks, and we know what the Democrats are capable of in terms of what I consider to be gutlessness in responding to it. And I'm just wondering how you feel about how things are going to shake down the general election. Thank you.
Well, Jerry, I enthusiastically have come out for Barack Obama. I'm an advocate for him. Let me take away, give you my analysis of that. I do believe he's going to win the Democratic nomination, and he's going to go against Senator John McCain. And I respect Senator McCain's service in our military. Barack Obama serves on the Veterans Affairs Committee, which just passed the largest increase in veterans benefits in the 77-year history of the Veterans Administration. It's in the law, $6.7 billion. So to go back to make sure that our veterans are getting taken care of. So, Jerry, I think it's going to be a battle of, do you want to stay in Iraq for 100 years like Senator McCain, or do you want to, focus back on al-Qaeda and extremist groups? And you can't do that unless you bring our troops home from Iraq so we could devote, the 7,000 more troops or so that we're going to need over in Afghanistan. So I think that's going to be a critical thing. And also, when you look at the big picture as far as economic security, do you want to keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing from our country to pay for Iraq and the tax breaks for the wealthiest 1% of Americans when we're a country at war? Or do you want to say, listen, we need fiscal discipline and those tough decisions, which I think that both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton bring to the table, especially I think Barack Obama. So, I think that's going to be the question. But I agree with it as far as, that's going to be a defining issue as far as Iraq and our economic policies here in America. Jerry, I do want to say that I'm sorry you're a Mets fan. I know Carlos Beltran said that you guys are going to win the division. That's not going to happen. The Phillies will win the division again, and I'm a proud Phillies fan, and I'll be there on opening day.
He's off the line. He can't defend himself. One last call before we go to break from Joseph, who is in Leominster, Massachusetts. Joseph, welcome to you.
Thank you, Jane, for taking my call, and I'd like to first off thank Congressman Murphy for his service and dedication for our country, and now continuing to serve in the United States Senate. This is a wonderful honor. I'm a Vietnam veteran and have disability for my service for PTSD. I'm a very high functioning person and pay a lot of attention to the politics and things. And there's so much I feel I want to say, but first of all, the war in Iraq, if we go back and get in all fairness that this is an illegitimate, ill-advised and everything wrong with this war, why has it taken so long for the politicians to wake up to this, and why has it taken so long for the country to wake up to this?
I will let the congressman answer. Joseph, I'm sorry to cut in, but I'm running out of time here. I've got to go to break. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with paratrooper turned United States Congressman Patrick Murphy, Democrat from Pennsylvania, about his new memoir, Taking the Hill. I'm curious, Congressman, in the book you write about the violence and the killings and the reality of war. And you said it either reinforces your faith, crushes it, or ignites a faith that was never there. And I wonder what it did for you.
Well, it really strengthened my faith. There I was talking, Jane, about I happen to be Catholic. That was how I was raised, and that's what I, believe in my adult life. And, I don't try and pontificate my religious views on other people, but I do believe that, I've been very blessed in my life, and I'm very thankful. And I know it happens in our religion. It's the Lenten season right now. But I remember there was one of my young troops went to me one day. I'm quiet when it comes to my religion. And he said to me, he saw me go to the chapel, and he said, we had a little makeshift chapel in our Fort operating base. And he said, sir, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. And he's like, why do you believe, in God and as a Catholic. And I talked to him about it. And I didn't say, and I was very frank. I said, listen, I could be totally wrong here. I don't really know. I said, but this is just, you know, what I believe. And, you know, that's how I try to live my life. I said, but if you want more information, I'll be glad to help you out and you know, lead you, you know, in that direction if that's where, you care to go. And he actually went on and was soon baptized and got his confirmed, and he became a cadet at West Point. So he was a young man who really grew up without a father in Texas and joined the Army, which was funny, Jane. I tell this story in the book. He joined the Army out of Texas, and he, you know, joined the Army thinking, okay, they're going to feed me, they're going to give me good training, and I'll, you know, live in the barracks, with, you know, with the other guys. He didn't realize they got paid. So here he is in Baghdad making $16,000 a year, going around telling everyone he is the most wealthy guy in all of Baghdad because he's getting $16,000 a year tax-free, which is interesting because he was so grateful for that. And one of the things we've done in this Congress is we passed a 3.5% pay increase for our troops. Now, would you believe we passed that? I serve in the Armed Services Committee, and the president opposed it, and he said that pay increase was unnecessary. He didn't just say it as a comment in a press conference. He wrote it in writing. This was unnecessary. So for the president of the United States, for our troops who are in 138-degree heat over in Iraq, he says it's unnecessary for them to make $18,000 a year. I think that's immoral. So I took on the president. I was respectful of his office, but I took him on, and the Congress did, and we won that battle. We got that 3.5% pay increase, you know, for our troops from private all the way up to general, and we're very proud about that, as well as, you know, that $6.7 billion for our veterans benefits, which Joseph alluded to, to target two signature injuries of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And
what about these extended deployments, Congressman? The sacrifice on these soldiers and their families is tremendous, and now the extension of their deployments is making it even worse for many.
I that is what I talk about as far as everyone focuses on the casualties over there, you know, the 4,000 that were killed in action, the 25,000 that were wounded in action. But it's the fabric of the military family that is so strained and sometimes so broken. That was the heartbreaking thing is, you know, when I, in my role, I'd have sometimes, you know, people who've given 20 years of their life, you know, first sergeants, non-commissioned officers come in my office. You know, these are paratroopers, you know, about 6'3", 220 pounds, all muscle, come in, shut the door and break down crying because they got divorce papers in the mail because it was their, you know, second deployment already back in 2003 and their wife said, I'm not going to take it anymore. And they, you know, don't know if they're going to see their kids again. And that's the stresses that they're under that I talk about in my book. You know, I was one of the lucky ones. I was engaged to a beautiful young woman who when I came back from Iraq, she dumped me when I came back and I was, you know, upset. But listen, we weren't even married. I didn't have kids. I mean, I was lucky. There was a lot of these other guys I served with that their whole families were broken up. And that's, you know, you look at the divorces that are up 70% in the military. You look at the suicide rate that's double the national average. I mean, this is what happens. This is the result of these engagements that we got to change. And, you know, things like the Webb Amendment, Jane, you know, Senator Webb, a Vietnam veteran, former Secretary of Navy, now Senator from Virginia, says, listen, if you're in the military and you deploy for 12 months for our country, you should be home for 12 months to be with your family before you go back again. Or if you're a Marine and you deploy for 7 months, you should come home for 7 months. Would you believe that the Congress of the United States of America does not pass that legislation? They don't pass it in the Senate. How could that be? There was not, couldn't be more of a clear bill to take care of our troops. And I would suggest, Jane, that, you know, taking care of the troops includes, you know, that 3.5% pay increase, that $6.7 billion for veterans benefits, but also making sure that we have the best damn public policy when it comes to where we're engaging in hostilities throughout the world. And that's what I'm trying to make sure that we lead the charge and really change the direction of what's going on over in Iraq.
Let me invite some more callers into this conversation. And Peter, who's in Southbury, Connecticut. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask Congressman Murphy whether there's one question that he would ask all the presidential candidates if he were moderating a debate on behalf of the American people. If there's one question he thinks that hasn't been asked that he would ask.
Thank you, Peter. Congressman.
After the first 100 days in your office, in presidency in the White House, how many troops will be stationed or on target to come home within the next 12 months? And to me, the most articulate of that answer is Barack Obama. He has laid out a clear 16-month timeline to bring our troops home from Iraq. I give him a lot of credit for doing that.
So you agree with that
timeline?
And I
know that's where that timeline, yeah, that, you know, two brigades per month to bring them home. We would keep in Iraq a small strategic strike force, not in the center of Baghdad, but in the north in a Kurdish area and possibly in the south to be, you know, train the Iraqis and to be there for them as an aid, you know, if they had to, if Al-Qaeda pops their head up, but not to do the day-to-day combat operations. I think he's articulated, you know, what we need to do, you know, in the current war and in current hostilities, unlike the other candidates. But that is the question, Peter, that I would ask. You know, within the first 100 days, who and when will our soldiers start coming home and what would you do? And I, you know, unlike compared to, you know, the Bush-McCain plan where it's, okay, we'll have them there for 100 years, that to me is outrageous and just wrong.
A couple issues, Congressman, that are coming up before Congress. First is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and I'd like to ask you about it. How quickly do you think FISA needs to be resolved?
Well, first, Jane, you know, I serve on the Intelligence Committee. I'm the only freshman on the Intelligence Committee. It's a small committee in the House. FISA is still in play. That's what, you know, we're still doing the surveillance, you know, overseas where we need to and here at home if need be.
But does letting it expire create gaps in the intelligence gathering?
What has expired is what was passed, the Protect America Act, which basically is what the act was, what the president wanted. I voted against it in August because, you know, I believe, and when I taught at West Point, we have three branches of government. They are co-equal branches, and there's separation of powers for a reason. And it's like, you know, when I used to teach the cadets, I'd say it's like rocks, paper, scissors. You know, one's not more important than the other. They're co-equal. And the president supports the Protect America Act, and he says it's all under the executive branch. We don't want these, you know, these secret courts overseeing what we're doing, et cetera. And that's, you know, that's wrong because FISA was in place because we were tapping the phone lines of Dr. Martin Luther King, tapping the phone lines of Jackie Onassis, not really doing it for intelligence foreign surveillance. So, you know, I believe in the Restore Act, which I fought for, I voted for, but the Protect America Act, which is interesting, Jane, it expired. There was a vote in the Congress to extend it for 21 days. And would you know, the president, before that vote came up, he says, even if you extend it, I'm going to veto it. So, and then, so it doesn't pass in the Congress, and then he complains that we don't extend it. I mean, they're not being straight with the American public, and I'm just so proud that so many members of Congress, you know, we have found our backbone to stand up to the president again and say, listen, there are three branches of government for a reason, and we're co-equal. And, you know, you can do all the fear-mongering you want, but that's what got us into this war in Iraq, and that's what's got us on this path to take away, you know, and chip away at our U.S. Constitution that is so important, especially now.
Another issue that's upcoming, a big Republican issue, earmarks. John McCain speaks of them. What's your stand? Are you going to give up earmarks this year?
I'm a co-sponsor of a bill to give it up. I voted against $3 billion in wasteful spending. You know, we've already established reform, though, with earmarks as far as this year. Two things. One, it is now completely transparent. It wasn't before, meaning every single earmark has a sponsor. You know what congressman put it up there and where it's going. And you also have to disclose that you have no financial interest of where the earmarks are going. And secondly, we have cut the number of earmarks and the cost of earmarks because there was too much spending going on. I think, though, we need to do even more. Personally, we've gotten, you know, those two things, transparency and cutting the number and the amount, how much the cost are. But we need to do more cutting because right now, as I mentioned earlier, that's why I happen to be one of those blue dog Democrats, fiscal moderates, fiscal conservatives, to make sure, you know, that we stop and understand that the spending is going out of whack. And you can compare it to, I already mentioned that it was $10 trillion in debt. We spend, it's like a bad credit card, Jane. We spend $21 billion a month just on the interest of our debt, nothing on the principal to pay off the interest, $21 billion, nothing even on the principal of that debt per month. You think about that when you compare it to education, which is so important to keep America number one to compete against the other countries in the world. In education, we only spend on a federal level $5 billion a month. So we spend four times as much per month in the United States just to pay the interest off of our national debt. I think that's wrong, and we need different priorities.
I want to get another couple of callers in here. Kevin is on the line now from North Reading, Massachusetts. Kevin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask the congressman, we're paying a lot for private security over there, and the other thing is kind of connected in that how long before, if we have another conflict or something, that no one's mentioned having a draft or not in the future? You know, it seems like everyone's avoiding that we need more troops, and something comes up, we're stretched to the bone, and how are we going to get more guys in there?
Kevin, thanks. Do you support a draft, Congressman Murphy?
I don't, Jane, and Kevin, thank you for your call. I don't, for the simple reason that, you know, I'm very proud of my military service, and I'm proud of the units that I was with in our Army and our military. But I want to, when I'm over in places like Iraq and I have my battle buddies over there, I want them to want to be there. I don't want them to feel like they're forced to be there. And that's a different, you know, mentality when you have someone against their will that's there because, you know, there was a draft. So, you know, I believe that we could have an all-volunteer force, but it has to be, you know, the right type of force. And you know, I think that if we have someone, in my opinion, like Barack Obama, who said, listen, we need a shared sacrifice in America. We need to make sure that we're doing what's necessary to meet the challenges that America face and the threats, and too. So, you know, if you give yourself to your country will give itself to you, whether that service is through the military or the Peace Corps or the Teach America program. I believe in that national call for service, but not necessarily in a mandated draft into our military.
You are coming up for re-election, as you well know. Your Republican challenger is a fellow named Tom Mannion, whose son was killed in Iraq. Given your backgrounds with your last election so rough and tumble, is this one going to be different in tone, at least, than the first? What do you anticipate, given your shared experiences and tragedies, really, in Iraq?
Yeah, Jane, I really hope so, because that's what I articulate in my book that is wrong with politics. I mean, how they, you know, went after me personally and what happened. I mean, I'm very candid in my book about that. I really hope and pray that it isn't as negative, and I believe in positive campaigning. You know, but, you know, I'm going to have a tough re-election. I mean, let's face it. I'm in a Republican district. There's 25,000 more Republicans, and I've taken very strong stances. I wouldn't give the president a blank check when it comes to Iraq. I wouldn't, you know, buckle and give the president the Protect America Act, because I don't think it protected America and our Constitution. I think it was wrong, so I stood up against that. So, you know, it's going to be a tough battle. And what's interesting, Jane, this year, you know, I'm not just necessarily going against a Republican opponent. I'm going to be going against these shadowy 527 groups like Freedom's Watch that says they've pledged they have a $250 million budget. And they're going to go after guys like myself because I'm symbolic. I'm the only Iraq war veteran there. I've stood up to the president time and time again because I think he has the wrong priorities and the wrong solutions. So, you know, I understand that I've taken that stance, and that they're going to come after me, and I'm going to fight tooth and nail, you know, to stand up for the things I believe in. What? But at the end of the day, Jane, I look at myself in the mirror, and I say to myself, I gave it everything that I have, and I stood up for the things that I believe in. In my book, I tell a story. My father told me when I was a young lad, he said, Patrick, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And I know it sounds hokey, but I think that's what we need in the Congress, and that's what I've tried to do, and I tried to lead by example. That's a 30-second ad on these things that I stood up to. But
so given everything that you've been through, Congressman, in your political service, your military service, what do you think you've learned about yourself, about your country, about your comrades? What's the most important thing that stands out in this very illustrious service career?
Well, first, Jane, I'm definitely not perfect. I can tell you that. And I mention it in the book. And my wife reminds me all the time. You know, I didn't mention it earlier, but my wife actually is Republican. You know, and I'm a proud Democrat.
Kind of mimics your own family growing up. Your dad was a Democrat. Your mom was Republican, right?
That's right. And, you know, I've joked that I've learned diplomacy the hard way. I've slept on my own couch. but, you know, my wife and I, you know, we understand, you know, what's going on right now. And you know, we understand also, you know, what the direction that we need to go in America. You know, most of Americans, whether Democrats or Republicans, we can agree on 80-90% of what's going on and find common ground if we're only willing to do so and only mandate that our elected leaders are willing to do so. And I've tried to do that and lead by example. I talk about it in my book about how I've reached across the aisle and I'm working with even very, very conservative Republicans on certain issues because it's so important. You know, things like, in my opinion, national security, on immigration, on spending, you know, I'm willing to work with them on all these issues and find common ground. But, you know, these folks have to be willing to work together. And I think it's a lot of it has to do with the tenor of how you treat people. You know, I just spoke last week down in the Congress. We had a prayer breakfast. There's a bipartisan Democrats, Republicans meet for breakfast on Thursday mornings, and I was a speaker. And I talked about that. And I talk in the story in my book on, you know, little things like I went to the one prayer breakfast where the Republican says, "Hey, Patrick, you need a cup of coffee." And I just had debated him vehemently 2 days earlier. But little things like that, you know, can go a long way when you work together.
Patrick Murphy represents Pennsylvania's 8th District. His new memoir is Taking the Hill, From Philly to Baghdad to the United States Senate. Thanks for your time today, Congressman Murphy.
Thanks, Jane. Looking forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.